Welcome to episode 113 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for Sunday, February 1st, 2009. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, the Sydney driver is found guilty. The Tour of Qatar has started. A little bit of doping news, more product recalls. The economy brings down some cycling events. And if you write a good story, you could win a trip to Africa. Following the news, Galveston follow-up, listener comments on the Montana yield stop sign law, and an interview with David Rowe, author of The Ride of Your Life. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes another episode of The Fredcast. This week's episode of the Fredcast is brought to you by listeners just like you. You know, there's listeners just like you who are sending in PayPal donations and just plain clicking on the advertising links at www.thefredcast.com. Going to stores you would go to anyway, getting the same prices you would normally get, but supporting the Fredcast. Thanks so much for your donations and your support. It's greatly appreciated. Hey, welcome back to a Super Sunday edition of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. Good to be back with you for another weekly episode of the Fredcast. It is really great to be back in the saddle. And I got to tell you, something I think I was remiss last week in not mentioning, and that is a hearty, heartfelt, grateful dose of gratitude to all of you for your understanding. You are all amazing. You know, over the last week, I've been finally catching up on a backlog of emails, going through emails over the last couple of months while I was gone. And you know, about 95% of those emails, they weren't asking questions. They weren't bringing me stories. They were all just emails of support, letting me know that it was all right, that I had taken some time off, telling me, go out, be with my family, get my job situation taken care of, and then hurry back. And I just want to say thank you to all of you for your understanding. It is, and I've said this before, and you know, sometimes it may sound phony, and I mean it every time I say it. I do this show for you. And when I get emails like the ones that I got over the last couple of months, you folks are just awesome. You're really amazing. And I just want to say thank you for your understanding. All right, enough of that. It's time for the news. At the top of the news this week, you know, this story gets just more and more unbelievable. Remember last year we were talking about the guy in Sydney, Australia, who seemed so irate at the group of 60 or so cyclists out on a training slash club ride that he tried to veer into them several times. Then he moved to the front of the pack and slammed on his brakes, causing about 20 of them, including two Olympic cyclists, to go down. Then, unbelievably, he sped away. Well, he's finally had his day in court. Of course, he said he didn't do it, quoting, "Now, I have nothing personal against cyclists," he said. "It was just an unfortunate accident that I couldn't help." Well, the judge did find him guilty, but wait till you hear the penalty. He ends up being found guilty of, quote, "not keeping wholly within his lane, negligent driving, and not supplying particulars after an accident." As a result, he was fined $1,200. According to my calculations, that's about $765, about 535 British pounds, and about 600 euros. Seems to me, considering the crime involved, that that's a pretty small penalty. But get this, he told the court that he had been out since about midnight and he was trying to get home. But he was unable to get around a slow vehicle that was in the lane, and that's why the reason for him veering into the cyclist. He was trying to get past this vehicle, but he couldn't do that. Then when he finally did pull ahead, he went to accelerate, but his car backfired, and then he had to slow down with his hazards on, and then he, quote, accidentally, unquote, put the car into gear, causing it to stop suddenly. Folks, I don't believe this, and I can't believe that the judge, the magistrate's name, by the way, was Chris Clisdell, gave this guy the benefit of the doubt and only fining him 1,200 Australian dollars. According to the cyclists involved in the accident, this guy caused more than 45,000 Australian dollars in damage. Again, according to my calculations, 45,000 Australian dollars, about 30,000 US, about 22,000 euros, and about 20,000 British pounds. Of course, the guy involved had no comment. His name, of course, Hassan Bakar, 34 years old. He lives in the Sydney suburb of Claymore. You know, folks, I am hoping that we don't continue to see things like this happening, considering the relatively light sentence that this guy got. Unbelievable. Well, last week, you'll recall, I had a slew of product recalls for you. Unfortunately, I've got a couple more. One that I neglected to mention last week, which I think is really important for a lot of cyclists and other athletes here in the United States and elsewhere, is the one by Clif Bar. In case you haven't heard, there is a widespread recall of products containing peanut butter here in the United States. There's a particular company called Peanut Corporation of America. They're a manufacturer and supplier of peanut butter for a lot of food companies and manufacturers, and they're currently under investigation by the United States Food and Drug Administration for a recent outbreak of salmonella that's thought to be caused by tainted peanut butter from their facility. Well, caught in this recall is Clif Bar. A lot of folks out there eat Clif Bars and Mojos and Luna Bars and Z Bars, and Clif Bar makes all of those. Clif has voluntarily recalled a number of their products. So listen carefully, because I know a lot of you may have Clif Bars in your pantries, in your saddlebag, in your car, or perhaps in your jersey pocket right now. These are the ones that have been recalled, and you've got to check the best buy and sell by dates for each of these. And if you go to the show notes at thefredcast.com, look for show notes number 113, and there's a link in there that will take you right to the Clif Bar announcement, as well as to the announcement on the FDA's website. But if you've got one of these flavors of Clif Bar, Luna, or Z Bar, check it out and see if yours is one of the recalled. So, Clif Chocolate Chip Peanut Butter Crunch, Clif Crunchy Peanut Butter, Clif Peanut Toffee Buzz, Z Bar Peanut Butter, Clif Builders Peanut Butter, Luna Nuts Over Chocolate, Luna Peanut Butter Cookie, and all Clif Mojo Bars. All of these products were sold in grocery, warehouse, and other retail stores throughout the United States. No other Clif or Luna products or flavors are included in the recall. And please note, just because I've listed certain flavors doesn't mean that your particular bar in that flavor was recalled. You've got to check the Best Buy sell by date that's listed on the bar, and you'll get that information by going to the show notes and checking out the announcements from Clif and the FDA. This is an important one. If you've got some Clif bars, check right now to see if they're included in the recall. By the way, if your bar is included in the recall, you can contact Clif Bar for a refund, and you can get to them at their website or via their 800 number, 800-CLIF-BAR. That's 800-254-3227. Unfortunately, I've got another recall to tell you about, and this is from Isaac Technical Carbon Bicycles, and they are recalling every one of their frame sets and complete bikes made since 2004. Essentially, the issue is that Isaac has found a potential safety problem with some stem and spacer combinations, and in certain cases, the fork steerer can crack and eventually fail. An eventual breakage occurring suddenly during cycling can result in an accident with severe injuries, and of course, even death to the rider. Now, thankfully, Isaac has not gotten any reports of any accidents resulting in severe injuries. However, they've decided to do this voluntary recall as a precaution on a voluntary basis in order to ensure the safety of their customers. I've got a complete link in the show notes to where you can get the info on this recall. But if you've got a bike from Isaac Technical Carbon, it's time to stop using it. Find your dealer and get your bike checked out. And the final recall for tonight is from Merida Bicycles. If you're not familiar with the name Merida, that's M-E-R-I-D-A. Merida is one of the world's largest makers of bicycles. They make bikes not only under their own brand name, but for others. And Merida is recalling their first generation Freeway CT03 and R3.0 folding bikes. And clients who have these bikes are asked to take their bikes back to Merida dealers right away to get them checked out. The issue here is that these are folding bikes, and Merida's put in a proprietary safety button that I believe is used to help get the bike to fold, and apparently the device can become damaged as users use these things, especially if they try to forcibly push this button in to unlock the bike. And of course, that could cause the folding bike to, well, fold at the wrong time. According to Merida, they started this voluntary recall earlier this year. They've notified about 1,560 of the 1,800 buyers of these bikes, and they're trying to reach out to find those other buyers, to let them know about the recall, and to get their bikes fixed. I do not have a link in the show notes. I was unable to find one. I found this story on bikebiz.com and then through a Taiwanese news service. But if you've got a Merida folding bike, take it back to the dealer where you got it, and they will check it out for you. Moving along from product recalls to professional cycling, the latest event going on right now is the Tour of Qatar, Qatar, for those of you who think I may be mispronouncing that. It takes place February 1st through the 6th in the Middle Eastern country of Qatar, and it's an interesting event because it gives you an idea of how some of the teams were performing in the early season, despite the fact that this event is on neither the Pro Tour calendar or the World calendar. Stage one was won by Garmin Chipotle and Bradley Wiggins in perhaps one of my favorite events of stage racing, the team time trial. As a matter of fact, I'm glad the team time trial is back in this year's 2009 Tour de France. I've missed it the last couple of years. It's one of the most exciting events, at least in my opinion, in stage racing. But again, stage one was a team time trial. It was won by Bradley Wiggins and Garmin Chipotle. They came in with a time of 6 minutes, 34 seconds. That was 1 second faster than Team Quickstep and 2 seconds faster than Team Katusha. The tour continues all this week until February the 6th, and I will have the final results for you on next week's show. There is a link in the show notes to the website, and what you'll find that's interesting is it is the same website as the Tour de France, because this tour is also put on by the ASO, the Amaury Sports Organization, the same group that puts on the Tour de France and other races. So perhaps it won't surprise you, therefore, when I let you know that Qatar is interested in hosting the Grand Depart of the Tour de France in the next few years. According to Tour de France director Christian Prudhomme, quote, "We're honored with Qatar expressing their desire to host a stage here. Japan, Turkey, and Scotland have also expressed their willingness, as this is the biggest race in cycling. But, and this is an understatement here, there are plenty of logistics issues we have to consider, and also the weather here in July," because of course you can imagine being in the Gulf, that it gets just a little bit hot in July. Going on, Prudhomme said, "To host the first stage in London was a big move, and we were thrilled to see the response. Over 3 million people hit the streets, and we got goosebumps seeing the enthusiasm. There are cyclists participating from all around the globe, and to offer an opportunity to be a part of the euphoria to different countries can do wonders to the sport." Cycling legend Eddie Merckx has weighed in because he works closely with the Qatari Federation, the Cycling Federation over in Qatar, to help establish the Tour of Qatar. He's hopeful that they'll be able to bring the Tour de France to Qatar as well. He said, "We already have had such a good tour, and now with the women's tour also coming, it's another big boost. For the Tour de France, however, we'll have to consider a lot of logistics. We'll need the latest A380 aircraft, for example, and the teams will have to fly in and out with ease. A lot of groundwork needs to be done and put into place. But yes, in terms of the roads and all, we have the perfect infrastructure." This is what Merckx told the Gulf Times in Qatar. So is there a possibility that we could see the Tour de France beginning in the Persian Gulf sometime soon? Stay tuned. Meanwhile, in doping news, there were rumors swirling last week that as part of the UCI's Biological Passport program, the program that's intended to help fight against doping in professional cycling, the rumors were that there were 30 riders whose blood was under suspicion as possibly showing the signs of doping. The UCI has quickly come out with a press release indicating that that statement is not exactly true. In the UCI's press release, they mentioned that these statements, quote, do not correspond exactly to what an in-depth analysis by the UCI experts has established is the present situation. According to the press release, in 2008, the UCI collected about 8,300 blood samples. Those were used to create the biological passports of about 804 riders. These blood samples go through a rigorous laboratory and mathematical model, and then that yields the individual blood profile of each rider. Sometimes, however, these mathematical models will kick out a particular blood sample, or in this case, perhaps 30, and will say, this one looks a little bit funny. And then those are then submitted to a group of 9 independent scientific experts who were appointed by the UCI to interpret the scientific and statistical elements of each profile and then give recommendations on whether or not there was any blood manipulation going on. What the UCI is saying is, yes, there were some blood samples taken that warrant some additional scrutiny, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those blood samples are an indication of any doping going on. So essentially what has happened here is somebody jumped the gun. Somebody said, oh, look, these samples have been, pardon the pun, red flagged. And as a result, that means that those riders whose samples those belong to, those riders have been flagged for doping. That's not the case. It simply means that those blood samples need additional analysis. Is there a possibility that of those 30, one or two or maybe more of those riders may end up under more scrutiny? Yes, but only time will tell after the independent analysis of these additional experts has occurred. So for those of you who thought, uh-oh, here we go again, stand by. It sounds like there's much more to be told of this story, and hopefully of those 30, if it is indeed 30, of those 30, hopefully none of them will end up getting red flagged. We'll see what happens over the next days, weeks, and months. Meanwhile, a rider who has been found guilty of doping, Leonardo Piepoli from Saunier Duval, he has now been banned from cycling for 2 years because of his use of the doping agent Mercera during last year's Tour de France. In addition, you will recall that Ricardo Rico, also of Saunier Duval, was thrown out of last year's Tour de France. He has also received a 2-year ban, as you well know. He was ejected from last year's Tour, and he is facing criminal charges in France as a result of his doping during last year's Tour. And finally, somebody who a lot of us were very disappointed in last year, Tom Bonin, perhaps one of Belgium's most famous professional cyclists, or at least current professional cyclist, is awaiting the verdict in his cocaine trial. And that verdict is expected in 2 days, on February 3rd. Bonin told a newspaper recently, quote, yes, the decision, of course, is in the back of my mind, but it's not in my hands. Maybe the day before the decision, I may not sleep that well, but we will see. And he told that to the Gulf Times in an interview that he gave to them in advance of the Tour of Qatar. He went on to say, quote, hopefully the jury will keep in mind that I'm on the right path now. I'm keeping my fingers crossed and hope that everything will fall into place. Once this thing is off my back, I can concentrate on the racing completely, and that's what I am praying for. So he's in Qatar, where he will be racing against one of his biggest rivals, Mike Cavendish. He went on to say, quote, this tour has always been competitive, and if you ask me, it will be tough for Cavendish, as he's coming here for the first time. Qatar is not just about the sprints. You have to tackle the wind as well. It will be about riding in the wind all the time. It will be interesting to see how he deals with it. As far as I'm concerned, I'm ready for the challenge. I'll have the results of the jury's verdict next week and what effect that will have on Bonin's 2009 cycling season. Bit of disappointing news for those of you who were looking for more professional cycling events here in the United States. It looks like the economic downturn and the resulting recession have caused the downfall of 2 2009 events, the first being the Tour de Leelanau as a result of Priority Health pulling their sponsorship from the Tour de Leelanau, the Priority Health Grand Classic in Grand Rapids, and the Priority Health Ann Arbor Classic. So far, those latter two events are still on the calendar, but unfortunately, according to Stephen Brown, race director for the Tour de Leelanau, they will not be able to host this year's event, scheduled for May the 24th, and they're hoping to be able to come back in 2010. Another event that has also been canceled as a result of the economy is the Oregon Pro Cycling Classic. That was supposed to have gone on May 11th through the 17th, starting and finishing in Portland, Oregon. However, according to Chad Sperry, the promoter of the event, quote, "We tried very hard these past 6 months to find the necessary funding to make the event happen. But with the city of Portland pulling its support and race promoters not being able to come up with a title sponsor, we're forced to postpone the event until 2010. Meanwhile, for those of you who are concerned about professional cycling in Oregon, the Mount Hood Cycling Classic and the Cascade Classic are both planned to continue in 2009. Mount Hood takes place June 3rd through the 7th, and the Cascade Classic takes place July the 22nd through the 25th. For those of you in the San Francisco Bay Area who have been listening to this podcast for a while and thinking, when are we getting a Paris-style bike share program like all those other cities David keeps talking about week after week? Well, your wait is about to come to an end, because your mayor, Gavin Newsom, was in Paris earlier this week, actually on Tuesday. And he announced that San Francisco would indeed shortly be getting a Paris-style bike-sharing program, just like all those other cities we've talked about. Apparently, Gavin Newsom was in Paris because Paris and San Francisco are sister cities. Now, here is how the program will work. Those of you who are interested will register for the program online and pay an annual registration fee as well as a security deposit. You'll have to do that with a credit card. Then you'll pay an hourly fee to use a bike, which will be able to be picked up at one station and dropped off at another. Initially, stations will be set up in the Financial District, Mission Bay, the Presidio, Civic Center, and the City College campus in the Ingleside District. There are still a number of details to be announced, including the exact location of the stations, the annual fees, the hourly fees, the security deposit, and the launch date. But according to Judson True, a spokesman for the San Francisco Municipal Transit Agency, quote, "The launch date will be as soon as possible." For those of you commuting to work in London, this may come as good news, because cyclists are now going to be allowed to ride the wrong way up one-way streets in London. Specifically, this is going to occur in seven streets in a project that will cost about £45,000 and begin early this summer. And then if the plan proves to be popular and safe, it could be expanded to other areas in the city. According to Christine McKenzie Cohen, the chairwoman of the City of London's Planning and Transportation Committee, quote, "This project has two main benefits, safety and convenience. It will make cycling in the city safer by enabling cyclists to avoid busy streets." Personally, I'm curious to see how this works out. It seems a bit counterintuitive to me that riding the wrong way up a one-way street is going to be safer. I certainly understand how it might help cyclists avoid busier streets. I'm hoping that our friend and colleague, Carlton Reed from quickrelease.tv and bikebiz.com, will be able to give us an on-the-scene report this summer to let us know exactly how safe and how sane this program is. Again, seems counterintuitive to me, but, you know, London drivers have been driving on the wrong side of the road for centuries, so we'll see what happens. You know, over the last couple of years, I've mentioned some events that take place in Africa called the Tour d'Afrique, and I've mentioned how great it would be to be able to go down there and participate in one of the events, and now you have the opportunity to do so at virtually no cost. All you need to do is write an interesting, exotic, unusual, or special cycling story, and the best story will win a trip to one of these Tour d'Afrique events. If you're interested and you have the ability to write a really good story, you could have a chance to win. I have put a link in the show notes to all of the information that you'll need to write your story, and if you do write your story and you do win, I hope that you'll be interested in being a special correspondent for the Fredcast and let us know about your experience at the Tour d'Afrique. And that will do it for the news for this week's episode of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. Well, you know, last week I did a quick story about going to support Galveston and getting involved in the triathlon festival going on down there. And I got an email from listener Joe, and Joe's email said, "Just listening to show number 112, and then this came in all caps. Thank you so much for mentioning Galveston. 3 years after Katrina, and New Orleans is still making the news, but because of the election and all the economic problems, the world seems to have forgotten about Galveston just 3 days after Hurricane Ike." Joe said, "I had 5 bikes and lots of tools, etc., that damaged in the storm when my house was flooded. Because we were self-contracting, I'm back in my house now, but it will be a long time before it's finished. But it is so wonderful to be able to commute to work on my bike again, and I try to make a little bit of time to ride every day, even if it's not very far. But I'm not sending this email to talk about myself. Would you please give a shout-out to some cycling-related companies that have been especially helpful in helping Galveston to rebuild? I don't have any association with any of them, but was really impressed with the level of customer service I received from them and their show of concern and support." So, Joe, I'm happy to mention Joneswear, Bike Tool Set, and Twin 6. And if you go to the show notes, there are links for all three of those companies there, as well as links to where you can help Galveston recover from Hurricane Ike. It's my pleasure to do it because it really is a tragedy when a natural disaster like this strikes anywhere in the world. When it happens here at home, and certainly someplace that hits home, because I've got a good friend who lives down there, I'm happy to help out any way that I can. Good luck, Joe, to you and to my friends Darren and Heidi and everyone else down in Galveston. Now, another follow-up to last week's show, you will remember that I talked about the pending law in Montana that is intended to change the law saying that cyclists no longer have to stop at stop signs, but they have to treat them as yield signs. I got a number of comments from listeners, starting with this one from listener Matt in California.
"Hello, David. This is Matt from Northern California. Very excited to get a new Fredcast in the feed and listening to that right now. Very nice to have you back and covering all that great stuff. Wanted to comment on the law in Montana, the proposed law, that will allow cyclists to treat stop signs like yield signs. And I thought about that, and, you know, I like that, and I kind of feel guilty because I like that. You know, when I'm riding around in my neighborhood or out on the country road, if there's a four-way stop, I'll slow down. If there's no cars coming, yeah, I don't come to a full and complete stop. So I like that law. Actually, I wish they would do it in California and then educate motorists to let everybody know that we're allowed to do that. I doubt that'll pass because it's just legalizing something that's illegal today, and I don't think it's going to change anybody's behavior. It's just going to make it legal to do so. So anyway, that's my opinion. I think it's a good idea. The way that it's worded still means you have to be safe, and if there's a car coming, you still have to stop. But I would support that. So maybe Montana goes first and then California second. We'll see. Anyway, great show. Thanks for coming back and glad to hear from you. See ya."
Hey, Matt, thanks for the comment. Really appreciate it. And for those of you who don't know, not only is Matt a listener and somebody that I met at the 2007 tour of California, but Matt and his family also do a great family-related podcast called Pizza Go Here. Go check it out. I think if you've got a family, got young kids, you'll definitely relate to all the stuff that Matt and his family talk about on Pizza Go Here. The rest of the comments were either in email or on the comments in the blog at www.thefredcast.com. Listener Steve in Indianapolis said, "A conscientious yield would be way better than a full stop. My vote, yes." Listener Dave said, "I picked up your episode number 112 and heard your story about cyclists and stop signs. You asked for feedback, and here's mine. Okay, I admit I'm a cyclist that doesn't obey every stop sign. However, I have several rules I follow religiously about my disobedience. Number one, I stop for all red lights no matter what. Red lights are almost always on major roads, and that signals the need to stop regardless. Number two, if I'm choosing to go through a stop sign, it must be A, an intersection I know well, and B, an intersection that I can see down the roads very well. Otherwise, I stop. And three, I will come to as slow of a stop as I can before going through and am prepared to stop at any moment if something comes up. Yes, there are many cyclists that aren't nearly as safe, and I realize that my disobedience still has consequences. However, because of the big M word, he says momentum, not Montana, I think that changes like this bill would be good. However, can we trust all cyclists to be as careful as the Montana bill still requires? That is the major question about allowing cyclists to yield through stop signs. Listener Daniel from Idaho commented on the website, I think it's a good idea for Montana to allow cyclists to run stop signs. We have a similar law in Idaho, and the basic wording is that you can run the stop sign if you do not take the right away from anyone else. If you do take the right of way, you can get a ticket, and if you cause an accident, you're pretty much guaranteed a ticket. Although if you cause an accident, you're probably involved, so I think the ticket's probably going to be your last concern. Anyway, going on. There are a couple of other interesting aspects to this. We're required to stop at red lights, but can continue through them if we don't take the right of way from anyone else. I generally avoid running lights and stop signs when traffic is around, as it is dangerous and confusing for drivers. But when you're out in the morning, it's nice not to have to wait for a light that doesn't have any bikes, or stop at stop signs when there aren't any cars around. So that's from listener Daniel in Idaho. Listener Trish had a simple comment. She said, yielding is a bad idea. How do you prove who's following the law if something bad happens? All right, here's my personal opinion. I think I'm somewhere in between all of you because, let's face it, as cyclists, at one time or another, we have come up to that four-way stop in the middle of nowhere. We knew miles before, well, not miles, but we certainly knew yards, hundreds of yards before we got to that intersection that there were no cars literally for miles. And therefore, we just went right through. But we've also seen cyclists who come up to red lights and there is a lot of traffic around and they still blow the light at their own and others' peril. Therefore, the way I come down on this thing is, let's leave the law the way that it is. Let's continue to make stop signs mandatory. Or perhaps what we could do is we could say, if you are outside of city limits or you are in an unpopulated area, that in that case, you might be able to treat the stop signs as yield signs. And perhaps in Montana, that's a large portion of the state. And that might make a certain amount of sense. But harkening back to when I lived in Southern California, I can't imagine treating stop signs as yields or treating red lights as yields because I know that that's going to result in injuries and deaths of cyclists, and it's going to result in a lot of problems for a lot of others as well. So I think we have to let the law fit the jurisdiction, but I can't see making a blanket law literally in any state or any jurisdiction that covers a large area, because I just think that there are too many variables and too many possibilities, quite frankly, for people to get killed. And I would like to have as many listeners as I can. So that's my two cents. I'm still interested in hearing yours. We talked earlier in the show about how the economy has had a negative effect on a couple of professional cycling events, and we're sorry to hear about that. But I've got some news for you that includes the words free and cheap. The first one includes the words cheap, and I came across this on a blog called How to Fix Bikes at howtofixbikes.ca, and it's called How to Make a Real Cheap Saddlebag. I've got a link in the show notes for that one. It's a really ingenious idea, and it is indeed an extremely cheap way to make a saddlebag. So if the economy has bitten you and you need a new saddlebag, here's a great way to get one almost for free, but certainly cheap. Now, the second story includes the words free, and this one is an amazing deal. You've probably heard the names Hunter Allen and Dr. Andrew Coggan before. Now, these folks literally wrote the book about training for cycling using power. Well, they're getting ready to write the second edition of the book, and as a result, they are offering for the first 250 applicants a free online power profile analysis. All you got to do is go to the link in the show notes, and you will get a free power profile analysis. If you are one of the first 1,000, you'll get a sneak preview of the book. According to Hunter Allen, quote, power is the tool for training endurance athletes. By comparing power results between cyclists, it gives insight into the athlete's strengths and weaknesses, helping us improve our training and racing techniques and strategies. Peak's power profiling system takes comparative data and builds a strengths and weaknesses analysis that allows self-coached and/or coaches a way to utilize power data comparisons to build more effective training programs and produce better raced results. According to Allen, quote, I'm hoping to collect over 1,000 data files to be part of a new comparative analysis, which will be featured in the second edition of the book, Training and Racing with a Power Meter. So go to www.thefredcast.com, click on the show notes for show number 113, and if you're one of the first 250, you're going to get a lot for nothing. Okay, next up, I am really pleased to bring you an interview with author David Rowe. David Rowe is a long-distance cyclist and an author, and he has written a brand new book called The Ride of Your Life. The Ride of Your Life is an ebook, and I've got links in the show notes, and of course, we talk about in the interview where you can find the ebook. Go to roadbikerider.com or simply go to the show notes at thefredcast.com and you'll be able to find the links to where you can purchase David's book. And if you go to the show notes, you will find a link there for a special preview of the book that you can read even before you even consider buying it. But I think after you hear the interview with David, you'll probably be pretty interested in doing so. What is really great is that David's appearance here on the Fredcast is part of a virtual book tour. Now, if you've watched any of the morning programs or really any news program, either in the United States or elsewhere, you know that when authors write books, they go out and they go on long tours across the country and around the world to promote their book, giving interviews to just a large number of media outlets to try to get the word out about their new book. Well, David instead is doing a virtual book tour. And in a virtual book tour, he's visiting websites, blogs, and podcasts instead of bookstores, cafes, radio, and TV shows in order to get the word out about his book. I am the second stop on David's virtual book tour. First stop was with Carlton Reed over at quickrelease.tv. Also coming up, he'll be with Lon Haldeman on Pack Tour. He'll be with Rob Lucas from Ultra Rob's Adventures. He'll be interviewed by Richard Fritz Meisner over at Cyclicious. He'll be with Gene Bisbee from Biking Biz, then with Chris Kostman from the Adventure Corps blog, then with Heidi Swift from the Everyday Athlete, then on BikePortland.org with Jonathan Mouse, and then finally on Bike Love Jones with Beth Heyman. I've got the entire schedule listed at www.thefredcast.com in a blog post entitled Fredcast 113 Preview, Ride of Your Life. So without further ado, here is my interview with David Rowe, author of The Ride of Your Life. I am talking to author David Rowe. David is the author of a new book that's just come out. The book is called The Ride of Your Life. And David, before we start, tell me what that subhead is again, because I love it.
Yeah, it's aligning heart and mind for success in long distance cycling.
Okay, so that's a pretty long subhead. But the whole point of this is, you know, we've talked before on the show about how to prepare for a ride and how to research rides. David, you go beyond that. Give me sort of your 15-second elevator pitch for the book. What's the book about?
Well, the book, I think you'd have to call it a training book in the sense that it's going to help you prepare for a long ride. But the book is really, it's not about, you know, how to ride, if you will. And I think that's where most of the books are coming from. This is really a book about why you would ride. And it helps you get kind of down deep into answering those questions. Because I think in the absence of a goal, and many, many centuries and other kind of organized rides have big goals that are built into them, like anything from the American Diabetes Association or the American Lung Association. You have people riding for a cause. But as soon as you kind of, the riders mature to the point where they start to get outside of that kind of environment, Understanding why you are going to take on a 100-mile ride or more is very important, because sometimes, you know, 70 miles in, 80 miles in, you can actually begin to wonder, you know, hey, why in the heck am I out here? And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people quit either in the ride or later because they don't enjoy it. So my goal is to actually help people really enjoy the long ride and to actually take something from it back to their personal lives after it's over.
So your book really is about training, but from a different aspect. So many books out there talk about wattage and heart rate monitors and, you know, putting together training plans, so many miles each day, so many days off the bike. Your book takes a very different tack to all of that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I, you know, many of us have, you know, bought lots of training books, and, you know, still more people have enrolled in, you know, spinning classes or even in coaching programs or gone to camps. And I mean, we all have great intentions, but really sticking to these programs, very few of us actually do. And I think that's why we, you know, we've all read, you know, Fred Matheny's, you know, 10 weeks to preparing for a century. And how many of us actually are able to stick to it? And I think if you did, you would really enjoy the ride. I can say that because I've gone through some of these programs and actually done it. And it's amazing how many great training programs are on the marketplace. But the problem is we don't stick to them. So my book is really designed to plug and play with any physical training program. And this will help you to get the motivation to stick to the training, get it done. It's like, for get on that trainer in the garage and actually get something out of it and enjoy it. If you can believe that, I think you can enjoy that time because you know why you're there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you talked about people who sort of start doing charity rides. And quite honestly, for me, as a long distance road cyclist, the way that I got started was because, as all my listeners know, I wanted to raise money for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. So I really went out blindly and started training myself for what was then called an MS-150. And following that, I said, you know, I've heard about these 100-mile rides. There's no way I can ever do it. And I started training myself to do centuries. And then I had the goal of doing a century and then 1 year doing a century every month. But you even go beyond centuries in the kind of riding that you talk about. You talk about brevets and doing Paris-Brest-Paris. So these are some very demanding events.
Yeah, they are. And but I have to say that every time that I'm doing an event and I see the cyclometer hit 100 miles, you know, I take note. I mean, there is, even of those of us that are going 1,200 kilometers or 760 miles in an event, that 100-mile mark sticks. I mean, you notice it every time they roll over. So I do think that the century is the kind of ultimate target for long-distance cycling, even if you go past it, because you'll start to break the long rides down into these 100-mile increments or 100K increments. And in fact, that's a critical factor of being success, is to chunk miles down into these long rides down into distances that you've done before and that you know that, hey, if I can do one, I can finish the next one. And if you think about just that upcoming segment and not the entire thing, you can actually get these things done. There's lots, the mind and the way we kind of get into actually in the ride is very critical. And we do get into that a little bit as well in the book.
Now, let's get into the book in a moment, but I want to go back again into how you get started with all of this, because you've obviously been riding for a number of years and you've worked up in distance, and this is really your second book. So first of all, how'd you get started in cycling to begin with?
Well, actually, I was going to UC San Diego and living up in, you know, probably 10 miles north in Cardiff by the Sea, and I was looking for, honestly, for a way to commute to work and back, excuse me, to school and back, and to take advantage just of the beautiful environment. That, and I didn't have, you know, two nickels to rub together. So I joined the co-op at school, a cycling co-op, and built my first bicycle. And got a very inexpensive, you know, rusted out Peugeot that I sandblasted, painted, and then part by part built up what I, you know, was really a really great bicycle, and kept it for many years. So it really got underneath my skin, and I rode ever since. I got into century rides a little later in life, and you know, as they became popular. And actually, to be honest, maybe even 10 years ago, the centuries became so crowded that at least here in Oregon, I believe they started to become unsafe. Mm. I felt they were so, I mean, lots of crashes, you know, lots of ambulances taking people off courses. And I actually was in some crashes, and I thought, you know what, I love the distances. There's got to be a way to go to do these long rides, 100 miles, 150 miles, without all the people. And that's when I found this area of the sport called randonneuring, which is brevet riding, you know, that kind of a thing. 200, 300, 400, 600K are the typical rides that you're going to be able to find in just about every state in America today, and certainly all throughout Europe. You'll be able to find these brevet rides.
Right, and those are to build up to an event like Paris-Brest-Paris, right?
Right. I mean, that is the granddaddy of them all. It's 1,200 kilometers from Paris out to Brittany, out of the coast, and back. It's a 90-hour time limit. Last year, over 5,000 riders showed up. And in fact, that was one of the inspirations for me actually getting this book done, was that, you know, 5,300 riders showed up and 1,400 of them didn't finish the ride. Mm. And you think about most of the riders came from the United States. That's a $5,000 bike ride, you know, separate from whatever you're going to spend on your equipment. That's what you're going to spend to get there and enter the race and to support yourself while you're there. And that's a lot of money to spend to get, you know what, 800 Ks into the ride and say, I don't really feel like finishing. And I think a lot of riders face that in these ultra distance, you know, these are recreational rides. Believe me, they're only races for a few of the people at the front. But for most of us, we're just trying to finish it and accomplish a personal best. But my goal is to help more people actually start, but those that have start to be able to finish.
So let's get into that. The way that you get people to achieve these goals, it almost sounds like in the book, You're basing a lot of your ideas on this gentleman by the name of Charles Hobbs. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. So Charles Hobbs actually lives in Utah, in your state. He developed something called the Insight for Time Management System, and with daytimers actually popularized this for, you know, a span of about 25 years. They may not be quite as popular, I would say, today as the Franklin Planner, but the concept is the same, and that is that in order to, for a busy person, you know, like yourself, for example, to be able to manage the Fredcast, to manage the demands of your career, and to be able to also maintain your family, I mean, those are a lot of pieces to a very complex life. How do you do that?
By the way, that's a very good question. I haven't answered that one yet. Sorry, go on.
No, it's true. I mean, it's very difficult thing to do. And I think that this system, which is based on core values, really helps you to determine just how much you're going to invest in each of those areas. Cycling for me, as I watched it, it's been, you know, big parts of my life and small parts of my life, you know, as I was raising my family. In fact, my son Evan, who's now just graduated from Oregon State University, is the designer of this book, and he designed the last book. He designed our website, Ready to Ride, and this in and of itself is, I view as a core value that is an extension of our relationship as, you know, he's grown into a young man, that's a piece of all of this. So this what Hobbes helps us do is identify what's really important to us, what are our core values, and then to actually allocate our time during the day, the week, the month, the year appropriately. So that something, you know, that so that your highest priorities in life are the places that you're spending the most amount of time.
Now, one of the things that I noticed in reading the book is that not only do you have the ideas of Charles Hobbes, but I'm hoping you're familiar with David Allen and Getting Things Done. I saw a lot of that in the book as well. Are you familiar with David Allen?
I have. Yes, I am familiar with him. And actually, I remember reading the book some years ago. I've read so much in this area, as you might tell from reading the book. I'm a really a student of goal setting and time management and really being successful. I mean, however we define that, you know, and I'm not talking about monetary success. I mean, getting to a place in your life where you're accomplishing what is important to you before it's over. I think cycling for me is a much larger part of my life today than it was because our son Evan is now, you know, out there on his own, and I have the time. but even so, I have seen many riders spend way too much time away from their families, away from their jobs, and create conflicts that were really could have been avoided. And I think if they had taken a little bit of time to think about it, they may not spend quite so much time on the bike or playing golf or whatever it is that might be easily done, but, you know, not necessarily the best for us in the end.
It's funny. I remember when I was growing up, not when I was growing up, but when I was a teenager, I had a family friend and the dad in the family decided that he was going to train to do the Ironman. Mm. And I'll never forget the toll that it took on his family because he was either eating, sleeping, swimming, running, or cycling. And that was it. He wasn't working. He was hardly with his family. I'll never forget how that just took over his life and the effect that it had on the rest of the people in the family.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that if you're going to train for a century, and this is the kind of the difference, if you're going to go beyond the century into ultra cycling or into randonneuring, it does require more time. And like, I know that like you read maybe Joel Friel or mm-hmm. Fred Matheny, they'll say, you know what, 7 to 10 hours a week training on a bike is really adequate. And I think for most, you know, serious club riders, that's true. And then if you're going to get involved in a century, you know what, you can get ready for a century if you're in shape in, you know, 6 to 10 weeks, and then it's over. But I think the world changes when you said, you know what, I want to do a century a month. And that happened to me when I said, oh, here comes summer. I'm going to run 4 centuries this year. And then, you know, if you go beyond that, you know, and all of a sudden you're not training 7 to 10 hours a week. You're training 15 or 20 to get ready for a Paris. That's a part-time job. Yeah. You better check in. And so in the book, I talk about checking in with your employer to see if they're going to notice the change in you, and they are going, you know, you need to say, will you support me in this? You know, you need to check in with your, you know, your significant other. They are going to be giving up time, you know, so you have these relationships, and in the book, we talk about how to take inventory of those relationships and check in with those people in your life and ask for their support to get you to the starting line, mm-hmm. because that's really all the work. I mean, it's really all the payoff too, is the training.
Now you've got 8 steps that you go through in the book to get folks through a for want of a better term, a training plan. It's almost a life mm-hmm. plan. But you talk about 2 different things, and sometimes people mix these things up, and I was hoping that you might be able to help the listeners out. You talk about goals, and you talk about values, and you've talked about them several times in the last 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Help people understand how those 2 things interrelate and how really having clarity about your goals and your core values can help you achieve what you want to achieve in cycling and literally in life.
Yeah, that's a really important distinction, and I'm glad you brought that up. You know, values essentially is identifying the areas of life that are important to us. You know, for example, you know, many people would say, oh, you know, actually having financial I don't know if the word independence is right, but certainly security, having, you know, some money in the bank so that if I need to go 3 months, for example, and I think all of us are concerned about this today in this economy. I mean, what if I needed to go 3 months or 6 months without a steady job? Would I be able to sustain that? And I think so financial security is actually a fairly common goal for us. Another one might be the, you know, family. And another one could be physical fitness, or it might be just health. So these are kind of areas of our lives that we are think about. And in the book, in fact, in worksheet number one, actually I provide a way to take inventory, and the readers of the book can actually download from my site samples of my own so that they're not starting with a blank slate. So you name these core values. And for me, I think I operate probably with six. And I think about, you know, finance. I think about my relationships with my family. I think about my career. I think about my health. And I think about, you know, actually, I also think about knowledge, you know, learning new things, which is important to me. So those things become the divining rod, if you will, to assess which goals I'm going to set. So goals are really specifically for cycling are the event rides, and not necessarily organized, but the rides that I'm looking at doing. And then, so I actually recommend that the first thing you do is make a list without rating these at all. Like when you step back and make a list for the next 3 years, what rides would you like to do? And then you rate the importance of those rides just on their own cycling value to you. Because obviously this is about riding. So, you know, for me, you know, I was just actually, as we're making dinner here tonight in advance of the interview, I was speaking with my wife about trying to come to a decision between riding Race Across Oregon in July and going down to California and riding in the Gold Rush Grand Randonnée, the 1200K. When it's a tough decision to make if you just say, gosh, there are two rides. How do I decide? But if you put them into this goal ride evaluator, and I look at each one as it relates to, you know, fitness, health, work, family, friends, and finances, you know, they actually look different. They cost different amounts of money to participate in. You know, Race Across Oregon, for me, that means I need a crew. I need a van. And so the total out-of-pocket costs on this is actually going to be, you know, quite high, even compared to being able to go to down to the versus the travel. So if you're thinking about that financial goal of keeping some money in the bank, you're going to think twice about how far am I going to travel? How many days am I going to be gone from work? Do I want to use my vacation days? That kind of thing. So the values are what you assess the rides with. And here I'll give you a tool and actually give each of these a numeric score that's a result of these values-oriented ratings. In the book I used this to make a decision not to ride Paris-Brest-Paris in 2007, instead to ride it here in the Northwest, to ride which turned out to be a great ride from Portland to Whitefish, Montana. So I think these are things that I use all the time to make decisions. I'm hoping that they will work as well for others as they have for me.
Now, one of the things that the listeners should know is that not only are you talking about your experiences and your values versus your goals and how you make those evaluations, but you've also got a number of interviews in the book, and they take up a fair amount of space in the book, but I think that they're fairly insightful. They help you really understand the mind of a long-distance cyclist and what goes into making the certain decisions that we make in our lives to get these events done. I'm curious, when you interviewed these folks, which of them, from which of them did you learn the most, and whose story was the most surprising to you?
I think I read, boy, that's great questions. I would have to say that I related the most to Kitty Gorsell in her story of Paris, Brest, Paris. And when she was so honest about the fear that you encounter when you decide to step up and take on an event ride that you've never done before. You know, if you've done enough riding long distance, you know that there's a fair amount of suffering involved. And things hurt, knees hurt, ankles hurt, backs hurt, and bikes break. And she talks about kind of facing those fears. For her, it was riding long into, you know, inclement weather, and not knowing if she was really up for it, but determined to find out. So, I mean, and Kitty's, you know, she's a, by the way, you know, she's 53 years old. She's an elementary school teacher. She's just a, you know, she's a person like you, like me and you, you know, like she's every woman, but look what she has accomplished. So for me, I think I related to her because I feel what she feels. I think the rider that I think is most important here is Greg Paley. I think Greg represents to me kind of the guy in your club who's, you know, a blast to ride with, but so good, you know, just always at the front. And he got into, and I rode the Whitefish, Montana, the Portland, Oregon to Whitefish, Montana 1000 with Greg. I should say with him. I was on the ride. The guy shows up with a full carbon BMC. We're all leaving, you know, with enough stuff, you know, enough food to last more than we need. I mean, it's in randonneuring, you know, you really can't take support very often. So you tend to carry what you need. It's not touring. It's like day racing with enough clothing to cover temperature swings up here in the Northwest from maybe a low in the morning of close to freezing to over 100 degrees in the afternoon. And you have to carry all your own equipment. You can't have a support van. So Greg shows up with basically naked. He had like a light windbreaker, and it's 32 degrees at the start. And this guy rode up there in under 60 hours. He broke all the rules, and he was willing not to finish. But to me, he represented somebody who – this was so important to him, not just to finish it, but – he really wanted to do it on his own terms. He wanted to ride his own bike. He didn't want to, like, get the randonneuring bike, you know, the bike with the fenders and the lights and all that. I mean, he would just clamp on a battery-powered light at night, and he just was inspirational to me. So I think a lot of people will relate to him because, you know, most of us know somebody like Greg. We probably all want to ride like Greg, and he shared, you know, the fear he felt as well, that we all do. But yeah, those are probably the two that I like the most.
Interesting.
I like them all, obviously, but you know,
yeah, of course, I did too, by the way. And I think that the listeners will. Now you've decided to publish this as you did your first book, as an ebook, and you did it through roadbikerider.com and Ed Pavelka. Tell me about that decision to do it as an ebook instead of as a physical, ink and paper, something you hold in your hands book.
Yeah. Well, I've spent my whole career in publishing. And 10 years ago, I made the decision to leave magazine publishing to go full time into web-based publishing. I work for webmd.com as my day job. And I think for me, that transition was profound. And as I left print and physical distribution and retail channels to go into a pure online environment. So for me, to be publishing electronic books today was really experience that I know that you can do it, but I see how much more effective it is at getting your work to the people that need it. A lot of my friends are you know, involved in publishing, you know, traditional print books. And I see how painful it is to try to get your book into Barnes and Noble, and, you know, it, and I pick them out, but any book reseller today, and to keep it there. And you have to ask yourself, you know, how many serious cyclists are really walking into a retail store at the mall, you know, purposefully? I'm not saying we don't all wind up there while we're at the mall once in a while, but to actually go in and look for a cycling book, it's really a very small sliver of the target market. Road Bike Rider reaches 62,000 serious cyclists every Thursday. He has a target market of the people I want to reach, and they can have the book instantly. So it basically jumps over all of that physical distribution to get the books in the hands of the people that need it. So for me, it's not a compromise. I have no intentions of moving this book, you know, to a print version. Mm-hmm. And as I said, this is our second one, and it's amazing how effective it is.
I got to ask you also. I know it was just released, and you sent me an email. You were just ebullient. Tell me how it did that first week.
Yeah, so it was actually in the second week it reached the number one on the roadbikerider.com's bestsellers chart. So we were pretty excited about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations. Lastly, one other thing, you know, we've talked about core values, and there's something that you're doing with the book that I think is worth telling people about. And it has to do with something called Loaves and Fishes. Tell people about that.
Right. You know, the book itself was a labor of love for me. It took me 3 years to write it. It'll never generate enough money to support a family. Not even close. And honestly, we're not doing this for the money, but it will generate some, and we want to actually pay it forward, if you will. Our family feels really blessed for what we have, and what we've tried to do with the book is to create a channel to get the money that's raised by the book to people that don't have it. So Loaves and Fishes is an organization, actually it's through the national organization of what's called Meals on Wheels. And here in Portland, it's called Loaves and Fishes, and what we're doing is taking the profits from the book. We're retaining enough so that we can, you know, cover the cost to, you know, to pay our web, you know, host every month. Sure. We're retaining some production expenses, but I'm not taking any salary or any profits from the book at all. It's all going to charity. We're also exploring some others. So once we've accomplished our goal with Loaves and Fishes, we're looking at another group. Oregon Food Bank is another. We're really trying to right now focus on getting people fed, and having volunteered in some of these places, we can see that these guys are really doing that. They also are retaining very little of the money for administrative costs.
So, of course, I'm going to put a link in the show notes for this show with all of the info of where people can get the book, where they can learn more about it. But how can people find you and the Ready to Ride site, and what will they find there?
Well, they can find more information about the book at the website. Actually, it bears the same name. It's called rideofyourlife.biz. Mm-hmm. And they can also, if they're familiar with the roadbikerider.com site, they can find it there in the online bookstore. Now, we also have a website called readytoride.biz, which I put up a story a week, and usually intended to kind of deal with some aspect of the mind, the body, or the bicycle for folks that are interested in long-distance cycling, and that's at readytoride.biz.
David, that thank you so much for spending your time with me today, and also, of course, for writing the book. I personally got a lot out of it. As you rightfully said, I've purchased my share of training tomes, if you will. And this one, I think, is really going to help me, as we were talking about off the air, get back on my CompuTrainer and get started on my goals for 2009. So, David, thanks again. Great talking to you, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate your having, and I just like to mention to your readers that if they would send me or you, they'll find the information at Ready to Ride. If they would send me a story about the ride of their lives, we are going to be creating a collection of the best stories we receive and publishing those in a free ebook with roadbikerider.com, and everyone that we publish will receive a free copy of our book, The Ride of Your Life.
Wow, that's awesome. All right, we will we'll look forward to seeing that in the future. David, thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. So that was David Rowe, the author of Ride of Your Life. It's a great book. Go ahead and check out the sampler. Just go to the show notes at www.thefredcast.com. And you can click on the link. It says Ride of Your Life Sampler and check out the book. And then I guarantee you're going to want to go out and buy it. Thanks to David Rowe for putting the Fredcast on his virtual book tour. It was my pleasure to interview him. I really enjoyed it. And with that fantastic interview with David Rowe, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. Be sure to be with me next week. I've got a great interview for you with Martha Van Inwegen from Action Wipes. I think you're going to find that really interesting. Martha is taking the cycling world by storm with her product, Action Wipes. For a preview, go ahead and check it out at actionwipes.com. If you'd like to stay in touch with the Fredcast throughout the week, one of the best ways to do that is to follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Fredcast, and you can find that at twitter.com/Fredcast. Of course, you can send me an email anytime. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. And if you'd like, you can send me a text email, or you can send me an audio file for use on the show. Or if you don't have that capability, please feel free to call the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 435-258-6FRED. That's 435-258-6373, or just use Skype. The Skype handle is the Fredcast. Tonight's PodSafe Cycling music comes to us from, well, once again, Rexomatic Records. Tonight's artist is Kerry Jackson from his album, Beat the Meatles. If you're a Beatles fan, that'll sort of make sense to you. It's a short song. It's called Lago Esmeralda, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. I will be back again next week. Don't forget that interview with Martha from actionwipes.com. Great products, a great person, and I think you'll find it to be a great story. But between this week and next, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride. We'll be right back.